It's definitely been an interesting couple of months, I guess, for myself personally, in terms of practicing what I preach about self-compassion and recognizing that it makes sense that there are things that I was able to explain away or file away. And rather than beat myself up about it, you know, going, oh my gosh, I can't believe that I didn't put 2 and 2 together or 13 and 13 together or whatever it is. Thank you so much for pressing play on today's podcast episode. It's a solo one, and I feel like I'm probably going to have a slight vulnerability hangover, I guess, in the words of Brené Brown, after recording this episode, because it does take a bit more effort, which, of course, effort, you know, that's a subjective term, but I find it more challenging these days, I guess, to sit down and open up about personal things, and I try and give personal things a bit of space to breathe first before feeling like I want to share things. And I think I spoke about this perhaps in the anonymous question episode, where I said, like, nowadays it takes me more effort to like record things or share thoughts, and I think that that is healthier overall. But in saying that, this is definitely a personal episode, and the reason I want to record this episode and share these thoughts with you is because I genuinely think it's helpful for other parents or aunties or uncles just to have in the back of their minds. And at the same time, I also recognize sometimes you'll hear information and it just doesn't land with you at that time, but it might be something that just kind of sits there, like just sits on your shoulder, and it's something that you might circle back to at another point in time and go, ah, that stuck with me for a reason. And I also think sometimes you can share all of this information with someone who perhaps objectively needs to hear it, and it still won't land, because if someone isn't open to listening to stuff, it's just not going to hit. And I, you know, as I reflect back, particularly on this topic, which you probably know a little bit, given the title of the episode, I'm going to be talking about my kids having an autism diagnosis. And there are definitely times now that I look back and I go, oh, I do remember a GP flagging something with me. Or I remember one of, you know, a parent from the kids' school early on mentioning something, and I just really wasn't hearing it. So it's just a bit of a caveat to say there's part of me that recognizes if someone's not willing to listen or not willing to see things, you know, timing is everything, and we all come to our own conclusions in our own time. But I wanted to share these thoughts with you because they may be helpful. Just quickly, a word from today's sponsors. Unless, of course, you're one of our Venti members, in that case, there are no ads and your episode is about to keep playing.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I recently recorded an episode with a family coach who helps to, I guess, strategize and create systems and really support structures and support the human beings, most importantly, who are, dealing with some of the side effects of having kids that do have a neurodivergence, or also as adults that are struggling with different executive functioning challenges. And I really enjoyed my conversation with Allison from The Incremental Shift, and I'm going to share that episode on the podcast, but I wanted to, I guess, preface it with some of my own thoughts surrounding my own personal experience, and of course I'm not a medical doctor nor am I a psychiatrist, these are just things I wanted to share with you from the perspective of being a mum who now with a diagnosis looks back and goes, oh my gosh, there were a few things I missed. And I originally thought, oh, I'll record this episode and it's like five things I missed. And then I started just making a couple of notes and I was like, oh, it definitely wasn't just a case of five things that I missed. There are things now that I look back and I'm like, oh, all of those things together paint a different picture to those things separately. But so many of these things are so easy to explain away. When I reflect, I can't help but ignore the fact that because the boys are twins, there were things that I was able to explain away and file under the twin kind of category. Like, oh, they're not doing that, but that's because they're twins, and I'll get into it a little bit more. So just take what I'm saying today as anecdotal. It's a conversation with another mum. I'm not an expert. If anything kind of pops up for you and you think that it's worth exploring, I definitely encourage you to do that. And make sure you're following the podcast as well, because when you listen to the conversation with Alison, we talk about a diagnosis, we talk about what it can bring for a child, for a whole family. We also talk about whether or not it's something that you discuss with your kids. And I won't get into that here because we cover it in that episode. So when I think about the things that I quote unquote missed with the kids, I'm going to just share these in no particular order. In regards to autism as well, I just want to make it really clear, I'm not at all an expert. This is just what I think are things that go towards that diagnosis and understanding the bigger picture and understanding my kids that little bit better, and myself as well. So number one that I've written down, the boys both struggled with different textures with food to the point where they would gag certain food textures, not even feeling the food textures, just on sight would make them gag. And there were textures that they just couldn't handle. Like there's no way that I could have served them up tinned spaghetti or something like that when they were toddlers. They just wouldn't handle it. Other textures like, you know, really claggy kind of oats really wouldn't work for them as well. Mints, trying to think of other textures. When they were like babies and kind of sucking on those pouches, yogurts and stuff were fine. But then as they got older, yogurt with lumps became a real no-go as well. The textures that they were drawn to were definitely dry, crispy, very, very bland textures. Even now at 10 years old, they would much rather pasta with no sauce than pasta that comes with any kind of sauce at all. And they definitely had aversions to trying new foods. Like getting them to try new foods was really tricky. And sometimes it was more than just a gag. Sometimes the texture of a food would actually make them vomit. And they vomited a lot, more so like around the age of 5, I would say 4 and 5. It was pretty common that if they tried something that was an unexpected texture to them, their response would be to throw up. And it was something that we explored, you know, to the point where one of my sons did have his tonsils removed. That was also because he was always sick with tonsillitis and not just a little bit unwell. Hospitalized with tonsillitis and he had glandular fever, and it was just something that, you know, there were all sorts of things that made us feel comfortable with the decision of having his tonsils removed, and the gag reflex was also something that was considered. Number two, an inability to undo jars to take lids off certain things, and also struggles with tying shoelaces. So those sorts of movements that do require fine motor skills, the grasping, the twisting, even now there are certain drink bottles that at 10 years old, they really struggle to undo. They'll often bring things to us and ask us to open them. And it can be really tricky, particularly before really understanding their struggles with fine motor skills. You know, I'd say to them, can you try? Show me that you're trying. Okay, it doesn't really look like you're trying, because that sounds awful to say now, but there is a real disconnect between what they need their fingers to do. And as a mum, I think it's very tempting and very normalized for us to kind of take responsibility and blame ourselves. Sorry, guys. I know that you can hear the dog in the background. Mum life, like blaming ourselves, pet guilt, child guilt, all of the guilt. But what I was saying is, it's really easy to just normalize taking responsibility and explaining things away. So for me, in regards to things like shoelaces or jars, I would just think to myself, oh my gosh, I've over-assisted them. I've made their life too easy, because with two of them at the same age and the same stage, it is far more effective and far more efficient if I tie your laces left, right, let's get out the door. Like, if I am opening packets, if I am opening the jars and I'm the one doing the drink bottle stuff, because I felt like I had to be quite a well-oiled machine. It was very easy for me to go, oh, well, they can't do those things yet because it's my fault. You know, I haven't allowed them enough space and time. And perhaps some of that is true, and perhaps some of that is not true, and that is just that pressure and guilt that we carry around as women in society. But yeah, now upon reflection, pencil grip as well, but mainly like pencil grip in terms of a pencil grip that is correct in the eyes of the school system and probably ergonomically and all of those things. And cutlery, you know, like cutting food, like they can use a fork to feed themselves, but they will really have to think a lot about what to do to cut their own food up. And again, me being me going, oh, that's not their fault. Like, you know, that's on me because I've just over-prepared them. So it's probably a little from column A and a lot from column B, to be honest. Number three, they have had social difficulties over the years. And again, I've kind of rounded that up and gone, oh, well, because they're twins, they've never really had to practice a lot of social skills because they always had each other. And because I worked from home, they didn't have to go to daycare that often. You know, they only went 2 days a week, and I was just able to really explain things away. Like, oh, they're just so used to having each other and they play so well with each other. And those social difficulties, you know, and not to the point of like with the boys in particular, and all kids are different. When I say social difficulties, just to be super clear with them, what I mean is they found it hard to relate to other kids and to engage in play with other kids, not because they were acting out or because they were hitting kids or anything like that. And this is the thing with the boys, they are high functioning and they also are so placid and so loving and so kind. They're not the kids that are like swinging from the chandeliers that you might think of, you know, and not even to be that, you know, overt, but they're just not the kids that stand out. And so social difficulties would be maybe not understanding the rules of a game and taking things really personally and feeling really rejected and having rejection sensitivity and just a lot of emotions, a lot of feelings. And it's something that I've always encouraged in the boys, is to recognize their emotions, to name their feelings. I've always been really supportive of the fact that they are both quite sensitive and intuitive and empathetic. And that can bring about all sorts of social difficulties with kids. And I would definitely say that the boys have both presented to have social anxiety and feel really overwhelmed and tend to retreat in really busy environments. And now that I know more, I can understand why daycare was really challenging for the boys, like a daycare center with the lights and the sounds and the high turnover of staff and the different textures and just everything happening, not to mention the transitions, which I will speak about later. Like, no wonder I found it really difficult getting them settled into a daycare center and ended up moving to a family daycare center that was much more predictable and much more suited to them, thank goodness. Next up, I've got these as 2 points, but I'm just going to include them as one. So I'll go number 4, different sounds that the boys have made at different times in their lives. So one of the boys has a tendency to kind of click with his mouth sometimes, almost in a nervous tic way. When things are a bit tricky for him, he might do like a little that kind of sound. And truthfully, I didn't even really recognize it that much. And it was sort of when Brendan started spending time with us, he said, oh, I've noticed that he makes that little kind of, I used to just call it like a bit of a cowboy sound, a little bit of a sound sometimes when he's worried. And again, in parenting, sometimes you just can't see the forest for the trees because you're so in the thick of it and you just love your kids so much and you accept every single part of them. Well, I do, and all of the quirks, and I just didn't see it as anything more than like, oh, he's just a kid making that sound. In conjunction with that, his brother makes a whooshing sound a lot. And when he was much smaller, and both of the boys have always had fantastic imaginations and literally will just play in the lounge room making sounds, and you know, they're very much in their own worlds. And I can remember being like, oh, it's just because I read so much to them. They've got such great imaginations. And maybe that's part of it. And maybe the other part of it is to do with them literally creating their own world because they feel more successful and more safe in those realms. And so one of the boys makes more of a whooshing sound, you know, and he'll still now whiz around their lounge room and he will make sounds like whoosh, like those sorts of things. And so, yeah, that's been a consistent thing. Now that I look at those things, I go, oh, yeah, like he's doing that now at 10 and a half. And he definitely was doing that at 2.5 and 3 and 4 and 5. Next up, number 5, I think we're up to, because I put those other points together. A lack of understanding sarcasm. The boys are both very literal, and sarcasm is something that I guess I'm not naturally a sarcastic person. It's not really my sense of humor. And I definitely have not been sarcastic with the kids. And as they've gotten older and they've gone to a bigger school and they've had more conversations and more exposure, and also I guess the media they are consuming changes. You know, they move from watching little kid stuff to now they'll watch a Marvel movie and those sorts of things. And so sarcasm has been something that we have had to explain to the boys. And even now they will check, they'll say, is that sarcasm? Or am I doing sarcasm in the right way? Because it's not only understanding it, it's also executing sarcasm. You know, they might go a little bit too far. You know that saying, do less? Like there have been times where I'm like, just do less. Like it, you could dial it back about 80%, of course I don't say this to them, but you know, they could dial it back about 80% and that would be kind of enough. But it's an inability, I think, to understand social norms and social cues. And so, yeah, doing a bit too much or not fully understanding the concept of things that may come with more ease to those who are neurotypical. Next up. So there is a crossover or a comorbidity between ADHD and autism, and how it all kind of started, you know, I won't get too into the weeds here in the inception story because I think I've probably spoken about this before. I don't even know if it was last year or the year before. No, it was last year. We were at a parent-teacher interview. One of the boys, his teacher, brought up dysgraphia. And my understanding of dysgraphia is it's kind of about spatial awareness when writing and pencil grip. And then it just kind of led into this conversation about, you know, not paying attention, flying under the radar and those sorts of things. And it was actually Brendan who said, could it be ADHD? And I had never considered ADHD for either of the kids before. And I didn't know a great deal about the differences between inattentive or hyper or combined or those sorts of things. And then That question alone opened up more exploration about disorganization. And so the teacher went on to say, oh, well, he is quite disorganized, you know, and he does struggle with these sorts of things. And I was like, oh my gosh. And I started like vividly just going, oh, he's so disorganized. And it's never really bothered me or been something that I've flagged because I'm so disorganized. We're two little tornadoes. And so during the process of exploring ADHD for him, which was quite a lengthy process as well, I did bring up autism with the pediatrician who said to me, look, autism and ADHD often coexist. And so the most like common path of action is that we treat the ADHD, and if the autism symptoms improve, then we just leave it there. And if they don't improve, then we might look at a combined type diagnosis or we explore other things. Because it really is like with all of this stuff, you know, you start pulling at the thread and you're like, I don't know where I'm meant to go to next. You know, like, what are we doing here? You can go down the path of medication. You can go down the path of behavior modification. Like there's so many things, I guess, that once you start peeling things back, you can look at and consider. And so there is definitely a crossover there with ADHD and autism, the little Venn diagram where some things could be either. And that is just, I think, worth noting for parents especially. Next up, clothing items, including socks. So certain clothing items are really bothersome, more so for one of the boys than the other. They all have, you know, each individual has their own kind of mixture of stuff going on. Both of the boys across the board can't handle tags on their skin. They don't like wearing tight clothing. The only time I've ever been able to get them into like a pair of jeans is when they're very, very stretchy and are more of a cotton blend. Like stiff fabrics don't work well on them. They both have really hated having to wear underwear. And it's like one of those things when you're little, they can get away without it. My kids could get away without it. But then you start going to school and it's like, no, no, you have to wear underwear. And so underwear has been a massive issue at times. And I spoke about it on my Instagram stories about how it is really trial and error. Because when I started researching a lot of articles and I guess links that popped up and Google ads were all about compression clothing, and that's just not it for the kids. My two can't handle firm clothing on them, whereas for other kids who are autistic, firm clothing is really, really calming. And interestingly enough, both of the boys do really love their weighted blankets, but they just, and like obviously that's pressure, but they don't like restriction when it comes to clothing. Like I can say with certainty, there is no way that I would be able to get like a fitted turtleneck or something like them, like that onto the kids. Whereas I know other children really do like that feeling of pressure and it's very calming. But even rashies, right? Like if a rashie is too tight, and it's very hard to get a rashie that is like the right mixture of, you know, being loose enough that it's not going to cause them pain and anxiety and make things worse, but also is like fitted enough that they're not going to get sunburnt because my two are so fair as well. But yeah, clothing is a big one. Tags, buttons, you know, the buttons on their school shirt rubbing against their chest. One of the boys has no issue with that, whereas the other one has to wear a singlet under his school shirt because he finds it unbearable. And I feel for him because at points he's been wearing like two outfits almost, because back to the underwear thing, for a while there, the only thing that I could find that was comfortable for him to make it through the day was he would wear a pair of bike pants, like actual proper sports, thick ribbed bike pants. And that was like, we only had one pair of those. So like every day making sure it was washed and ready to go for the next day, all of that stuff. But, you know, just thinking about him at school in the heat and the humidity, wearing bike pants and shorts and a singlet and his shirt, because we had to make sure I had to help him have fabric that felt okay on his skin, because it's more than just like, oh, that's annoying. You know, sometimes I'll put on a shirt and I'm like, oh, that tag's annoying, and I might snip it off. But it's more than that. It's not just a simple like, oh, it's a little bit irritating. It's distressing almost. And at times it can be distressing.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
With underwear, I have found two underwear options that seem to be working really well, and that could change at any moment, maybe even by the time this podcast is live. But at present, Bonds have a temperature control trunk that seems to be working really well. Just for those of you who are playing at home and are actually like, oh, I know exactly how this feels, the temperature control trunk. And then the other thing that I found at Big W was a really, really lightweight sports bike pant that has been good as well. Socks are a huge one. And again, this is more than just like, oh, my sock isn't comfortable or my sock is not on correctly. It's a real thing. Like if the socks don't go right on of a morning and they're not the right pair, and we've ironed it all out now, like it says, you know, mornings are great. But before understanding how upsetting it was for him, really, it was just hard to, I guess, understand how a sock could derail his whole morning and his whole attitude, and it could really, really impact him so significantly. But it does. Like it just is what it is. You can be like, oh, how silly, it's a sock. But it truly is not just a sock to someone who is having a sensory overload or a sensory issue. And again, like there are all sorts of special seamless socks that you can buy. Those didn't seem to help my son. I have found a pair of mesh anklets, again, from Bonds, that work really well. And that was an accidental discovery. Like so accidental. Like my mum left a pair of her Bonds anklet socks here. And I just said to him, I'll just try these on one day, because he didn't want to wear tall socks because the taller socks were bothering him. And he's like, these are the best. And so again, I found myself in that situation of like making sure the bike pants and the socks were washed every day. I'm like, this is madness. I need to just go and buy more of these socks because they're working. And so they've kind of just got like mesh, like they're very breathable, and that seems to be going really well for him. So for any parents who are like spending a lot of money on specialized items, it's like sometimes it's like you just have to do that. You just have to buy the expensive compression singlet if you can. And other times it's at least worth exploring more affordable options first. And seeing if that helps, because so much of this stuff is truly so expensive. Next up, hyperfixation. So the boys both hyperfixate on certain things, and when they're in a state of hyperfixation, they could just monologue to you, to anyone, about what they are interested in with no breaks, with no consideration for any of the social cues you might be giving or not giving back. And it's like being hit almost by a freight train in a way. You know, like it's incessant, it's an overload. You may ask them a simple question like, are you enjoying that book? You know, that's a really familiar experience. Like I might say to them, hey, is that a new book from the library? Are you enjoying it? And next thing you know, it's 25 minutes later and it hasn't been a simple yes, no, I'm really liking it, or a summary. It's a blow by blow of every single page and every single thing that can be recalled, like right down to really minute details. Hyperfixation on topics, books, themes, shows, anime, Dungeons and Dragons. That's a big one. And I speak about this a little bit with Allison, because it can be challenging as a care, like as someone that's looking after them, It can be challenging to understand how they can retain so much information about really in-depth things, you know, that they can know all of the names of all of these different imaginary creatures that have all of these rules that go along with it, but struggle with more simple tasks like remembering to put their hat in their bag every day. And Alison explains that beautifully in our conversation, so I'll leave that one there and make sure you listen to that episode. The boys are definitely both homebodies. I saw a TikTok, funnily enough, recently talking about how, like, sometimes when you have autism, you feel the need to have like an autistic nest with you. And again, this is, I'm telling you, something I saw on TikTok. I don't know I don't know how scientifically accurate this is or medically accurate, but it was one that I was like, yes, the boys do that. And maybe all kids do it. I don't know. But they'll have like their 6 or 7 items that go everywhere with them. So of a morning, my son will come down. He's carrying 4 books, a pair of headphones, a jumper just in case it's cold, 2 water bottles because he has to have 2 water bottles at night. And like he's never drunk 1 water bottle overnight, but he has a worry that he will run out of water, even though we have taps upstairs. It's all of these little things of like they have their stuff and their stuff goes everywhere with them. And they're also definitely much more comfortable at home, which I think is probably to do with stimulation overload and feeling safe and calm and having everything that they need to calm down at home. They have always been very good at self-regulation in terms of taking themselves off to read a book or taking themselves off to do an activity if they need to calm down. And so being at home allows them to have access to that, I guess, with a lot of ease. And there's also a lot of predictability and stability, which is calming for them. And with friends, whenever they have friends like play dates arranged or hanging out now that they're older, it's always been here at our house. And I've always loved that. I am so happy to be the house that the kids come to. I don't mind. I don't mind if we have to feed extra kids. I don't mind the extra noise. It just doesn't bother me at all. I like it. And I guess I've always kind of gone, oh, it's just easier for kids to come to ours because there's 2 of them. And they do tend to share friends. So rather than like me dropping my 2 kids over and feeling like someone else has to be responsible for 2 kids, it's easier if that 1 kid comes to us. And I think that's part of it. but I also think part of it for the kids is that social anxiety, the social difficulty, knowing that they've got their stuff and knowing that they've got access to those self-regulation tools that we have just built into their lives without even really understanding why, prior to getting a diagnosis, I mean. Next up, routine. You know, I literally had a business all about routines. I am a routine mum and I just felt like I needed to be that way when they were babies, and I do not regret having a routine at all. I think a routine gives us freedom in a lot of ways. And at the same time, I've also had moments where I've gone, oh my gosh, maybe my routine is what has made them rigid. But now that I know about autism and I understand it more and I understand how difficult a change of routine can be or not being able to predict the outcome of things, I don't like blame myself as much for that rigidity that I have seen in them before. And they definitely don't have like big meltdowns if something changes or the schedule is a bit different, but I've always over communicated with them about what to expect and about what possible outcomes may be. And that routine and structure, I think, does provide them with a sense of safety and stability, and it meets their needs. Again, there are just things that I have done with the kids that, you know, are things that I think people would recommend you do with kids that have a neurodivergence. Even prior to having that diagnosis, it's just something that I intuitively recognized they needed. Or perhaps because of my own neurodivergence, I was like, oh, this makes life easier. I'm just going to extend that out to the people around me as well. I guess in terms of routines as well, my next point is that transitions have been hard for the kids, whether that's a transition to daycare, to someone else looking after them, to their dad's house. transitions to school. They have really struggled with those periods. And again, I've tried to make things as routine as possible because that helps them to feel safer, knowing that they can predict the outcome and they can expect what's going to happen. But yeah, if your kids are really, really struggling with transitions and there's also, you know, a myriad of other little puzzle pieces, that could just be one that clicks in and makes sense as well for you. It's definitely been an interesting couple of months, I guess, for myself personally in terms of practicing what I preach about self-compassion and recognizing that it makes sense that there are things that I was able to explain away or file away, and rather than beat myself up about it, you know, going, oh my gosh, I can't believe that I didn't put two and two together or 13 and 13 together or whatever it is, you know, just going, oh, that's just because I'm just their mom and I just see them as individuals, you know, and it wasn't like I was looking for anything more than just how can I meet the needs of these beautiful individuals that I love so much. I've spoken before about The Highly Sensitive Child. It's a great book. It's a great ethos. There's the highly sensitive person as well. And I definitely applied that lens to the kids. And I can also see how like the highly sensitive child can also intersect with other neurodivergence things, you know, like these little bits and pieces, like the social difficulties and the worries and the ruminating thoughts. One of the boys has ruminating thoughts so often. Again, you know, another little note that I had written down here was just like, I feel like I intuitively addressed a lot of this stuff without even the diagnosis in terms of having a routine, over-explaining, always making sure they knew how to name their feelings, giving them the tools of self-regulation without understanding that it went hand in hand potentially with an autism diagnosis for them, you know, in terms of using cool water on their wrists or the Snap-Lock bag of ice on their forehead and all of that sort of stuff, that the more I explore, I'm like, oh, I understand why. But yeah, it just was something that I was doing with them anyway. So I wanted to share this episode with you, as I mentioned at the start, ahead of my conversation with Allison, because I think it just goes well with that conversation and it adds a little bit more of a personal context as well. And maybe it's helpful for other parents out there. If it is, slide into my DMs and let me know or leave a comment. It truly does make a difference. Make sure you're following the podcast so that when Allison's episode is live, it just drops into your podcast feed without you having to search for it. Following the podcast is not the same as subscribing. So we have the subscriber option where you have bonus and ad-free episodes, and it's a great way to support the podcast if you enjoy it as a resource. But following the podcast is not committing to signing up and subscribing. It's just making sure you then have the notifications in your library. And it helps me as a podcast creator, because the more people that click follow on the podcast, it puts it in front of other people. And it's just a helpful thing if you enjoy the pod. My conversation with Allison includes things like, as I mentioned, why you would get a diagnosis, what to expect after it, whether you share that with kids. Allison talks about the twice exceptional diagnosis and offers some strategies that are really, really helpful for families that do have a neurodivergent family member or members. But truthfully, there's strategies that Allison shares that are just helpful for anyone. You know, like literally anyone who is busy and trying to care for small humans will benefit from that conversation. So thank you so much for listening. Keep an ear out for the next episode, and I appreciate you being here. Thank you so much for listening to today's podcast episode. If you want more of the I Am podcast in your ears, make sure you become a podcast subscriber. It is really, really simple to do. All of the details are in the show notes. For the cost, actually less than the cost of a cup of coffee per month, you will receive access to exclusive podcast episodes. That's right, you'll get a bonus episode every single week that you will not hear anywhere else. And to be honest with you, I really am sharing a lot more over in those exclusive episodes. It feels like a really safe zone for me. So make sure you check out the subscription offers that we do have available for that exclusive content. And perhaps best of all of the episodes will be ad-free. So if you feel good about supporting a female-founded, female-led business, check out the subscription offerings available and become a podcast supporter today. Today's podcast episode was recorded on the land of the Bundjalung Nation. In the spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respect to their elders, past and present, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.